the show starting a little earlier than it typically does. And, you know, just for a number of circumstances, including those, I'm feeling a little bit out of sorts. So I'm gonna give you a little peek behind the curtain. That's what we're going to start with tonight on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can stream us at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. Appreciate you tuning in. 9 to 11 weeknights is when we're typically here, starting a little bit earlier after your Gophers hockey. 651-989-5855, the number to join us this evening. Brad Ullman taking your calls and producing the show. You know, when I go through my prep process, when I'm researching stories, getting all read up on the news of the day in order to come here at night, the process that I follow is far more instinctual than thorough. Let's put it that way. There are a lot of headlines that I read and I just pass on, even though, you know, there may be some incredible nugget in there. There might be some amazing topic that could fuel half an hour of phone calls or whatever the case may be. But if my instincts don't fire off just on reading the headline, then I'm not going to spend a lot of time investigating further because I just don't have a lot of time. And one such headline, just to give you an example, it was just talked about in your bottom of the hour news there. Coming to us from NBC News, Arizona Representative Trent Franks quits after asking female staffers about surrogacy. Now, this is something that the surrogacy aspect of it is something that I saw yesterday or the day before, whenever this first became a thing that was being talked about. And it caught my attention just because it's a strange headline, right? He talked to female staffers about surrogacy. Now, on its face, see, I know what surrogacy is, but in my head, I'm thinking it can't possibly be that. Like, it can't possibly be that he was talking to women about having his baby. Like, that can't be what it was. And so I just skipped past it, went on to other headlines, you know, prep for those day shows accordingly. No, it turns out that's exactly what it was. He was asking female staffers if they would be interested in carrying his child. This is the world that we live in now, where these kinds of things are happening. Continuing at NBC News, Franks announced his resignation Thursday evening as the House Ethics Committee announced it was opening an investigation into potential sexual misconduct. Franks said in a statement that he had discussed his interest in finding a surrogate mother with two women in his office, making them uncomfortable. His wife has struggled with infertility, he said. The ethics committee said that it was convening a subcommittee to determine if Franks engaged in conduct that constitutes sexual harassment and or retaliation for opposing sexual harassment. Though Franks originally said he would step down at the end of January, the lawmaker announced Friday that he was resigning effective today. Now, what I just read for you there is the totality of what I know about this story. Okay, I've not researched it extensively. I don't know a whole lot about it. I don't know a whole lot about this guy. But one of the things that has been a recurring theme in our consideration of these myriad episodes of allegations of sexual misconduct has been the broad spectrum of things that people have been accused of. Like, on the one hand, I think the far end of the spectrum is represented by the accusations against Roy Moore, where he's basically been accused of being a pedophile who's engaged in predatory sexual assault against minor children, teenage girls. That's one end of the spectrum. And, you know, a little bit closer, a little bit further inward from that, you get things like Louis C.K. going around just kind of volunteering exhibitions of himself to women unsolicited, right? Like, that's kind of over there on that side of the spectrum as well. But then you get things way over on the other side of the spectrum, like the Garrison Keillor thing, which all we know of at this point is his side of the story, which is that apparently a woman was telling a sad story, and in order to console her, he went to pat her on the back, and her blouse was open, and he touched bare skin. And that apparently constitutes sexual misconduct of some kind. And I would put this right there. I mean, it's like the headline is weird. The story is strange. The fact that he did this is odd. But sexual harassment? Is it is it sexual harassment to talk to? Now, I'll grant you, it's unwise. It's not something you probably should do. It's kind of a minefield. Like, there's no good way to broach that topic in that context. Again, the problem here, and this is something that Brad brings up rightfully whenever we talk about these sorts of things, the employment context. It's not like you're walking up to a woman on the street or to somebody that you know outside of some sort of relationship where they're effectively a captive audience and ask them, hey, are you interested in being the surrogate for my child? These are people who work for you, and therefore, as a condition of making a living, have to see you on a day-to-day basis. And so when you make them uncomfortable in such a personal way that has nothing whatsoever to do with their job duties, and yet they can't really remove themselves from the situation because they're at work, that is a problem. Now, is it a problem on the level of sexual harassment? I tend to think not. Again, not knowing a whole lot about the situation above and beyond what I just read to you. But, you know, here's another thing to add to the pile, our ever-growing pile of episodes of allegations of sexual misconduct. So there you go. Of course, recently we know that our own senator here in Minnesota, Senator Al Franken, has announced that he is going to resign in the wake of his own controversy, his own scandal involving multiple allegations from multiple women regarding supposed sexual misconduct. And that has created an interesting political situation here in the state, as his replacement will be picked by sitting DFL Governor Mark Dayton. And there's some news on that front over at the Star Tribune. With Governor Mark Dayton publicly mum about who he'll name to be Minnesota's next U.S. Senator, his likeliest pick, Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith, is not ruling out her own run for the seat in 2018, should Dayton pick her, according to a Democratic source. Now, the reason why this is news, because we were talking about this last night, the reason why this is news is because of that fine detail, the fact that she is considering running for re-election, because that's what it would be if she's selected or appointed by Governor Dayton to fill Franken's seat. She'll serve out his term through the end of next year. But the question has been, the assumption was that she would not run in 2018. And apparently some of the Democratic muckety-mucks behind the scenes were more interested in having somebody appointed to that seat who is interested in running in 2018, because it's politically advantageous to be able to ramp up, to basically use your newfound incumbency as a platform for campaigning, essentially. That's what they're looking for. And so it seems likely to me that those bees have been buzzing in Tina Smith's ear and basically saying, look, are you willing to run or not? Because if you're not, then we should probably find somebody else for the governor to appoint, which is probably why the governor is playing these cards close to his chest as these conversations are taking place with Tina Smith. Star Tribune continues, Smith was initially seen as a placeholder replacement for Democratic Senator Al Franken, who would only serve through the next year and be replaced by whoever wins the 2018 special election. But the Democratic operative who's been privy to Smith's thinking told the Star Tribune that she has not taken a run for the office off the table, with National Democrats viewing Dayton's appointment as a chance to give the party a head start in holding Franken's seat. Franken said Thursday that he would leave the Senate in the coming weeks after he was engulfed in controversy over allegations of groping and kissing women without their consent.
Well, it's interesting that, like, Dayton is thinking about not appointing Tina Smith because she might run anyways. Or she might run because Franken is resigning, because it shows you how uncertain the Democrats are of winning that seat now. If it was a given, that Democrats would win, they would just appoint her and say, okay, yeah, go have fun. But they know that she has to campaign for the job.
This is true. So you're saying that they actually have some concern, like generally, generically, they have concern of whether or not they're going to be able to keep the seat in 2018.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, now the Minnesota GOP has a year to beat the drum on look at how bad the Democrats in our state are, and look at how bad of a job Al Franken did. We need a Republican in there. Because I guarantee that most people aren't thinking of it on the level of, like, comparing it to Roy Moore.
Mm-hmm.
The average person is not thinking that. But the Republicans can rally. Democrats might use that as a talking point to rally Democrats.
Right.
But Republicans aren't going to use that as a talking point to rally Republicans. They're going to say, look, Al Franken resigned. Like, they can localize the issue. That's mm-hmm. federalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can say, look at Al Franken. Look at how bad of a job he did. Like, he's not a pure person. The Democrats are evil people for supporting him in Minnesota. So let's get a Republican in there.
Yeah, it would be interesting to be a fly on the wall of the respective war rooms at the state parties to hear what the concerns are and what informs them. Because my read, as I articulated last night when we were talking about this, is that the resignation of Al Franken, while it certainly shakes things up procedurally and, you know, gives us something to talk about more or less, it doesn't really change anything in terms of the actual political dynamic in the discourse. It's not going to change how these campaigns for 2018 play out ultimately, because it's going to be old news by time we're really talking about who's going to be the next senator for Minnesota.
But I mean, it's already campaign season again, so now is the place to start for the GOP.
Yeah, but the news cycle, which kind of mimics the political issue cycle, is so short that I can't believe that in, let's say, maybe it doesn't have to be October, but August of next year, that we're still going to be talking about Al Franken and his sex scandals as it relates to who's going to be the next senator from Minnesota.
We won't, but like now, I mean, I've called on the GOP before, the Minnesota GOP, to stop being so boring.
Right,
and
right,
now
right.
would be the time to stop being so boring. Get a candidate or two or three out there speaking sure. out against the issue.
Sure.
Take advantage of it politically, and that's not happening.
I'm surprised that we haven't seen some headline about who the GOP is thinking about putting up for this seat in particular.
Now is the time.
Because I remember the last time that Al Franken was up for re-election, there was, you have to go further back than that. The last time that Klobuchar was up for re-election, there was a lot of interest in running against her, but a lot of the names that were being bantied as potential candidates to run against Klobuchar were keeping their powder dry because they were more interested in running against Franken. And the conventional wisdom was that when a couple of years later, when it was Franken's turn to run for re-election, that we were going to have a lot of people on the Republican side who are going to be challenging him for that. As it turned out, that was not the case, because somehow, some way, Franken solidified his hold on that seat in those intervening years to the point where it was no longer regarded as this great opportunity to run against Al Franken.
Well, he's no longer seen as the comedian, and now he's the politician.
Right, yeah. He grew into the role. And he became an institution unto himself, and it was going to become much more difficult to uproot him than it would have been, you know, 2-4 years prior to that. But, you know, it'd be interesting now that he's clearly had a fall from grace, and the seat is basically effectively going to be an open seat. I mean, even if it is held by Tina Smith or whoever the governor appoints, for all intents and purposes, we're talking about an open seat here. It's going to be interesting to see if that triggers on the Republican side a slew of people who are interested in it. Because up to this point, to my knowledge, Jim Neuberger remains the only candidate who has announced for Klobuchar's seat. And another interesting point that I haven't really thought through or know about, and if you know out there, please let me know, 651-989-5855, because this never happens. Like, you never have both senators up for election at the same time. So how is that going to work? Is it going to be like an at-large race where the top two vote-getters get to be senator from Minnesota, or is it going to be you run for the different candidates run for each seat and you have to pick one for both?
Well, the former only happens in Minneapolis. But well, it will be two separate. Well, yeah, that is interesting. You'd think it would be the first way.
Well, because,
but that's not how it's going to be.
Because you could imagine a scenario where you have the second vote getter for one of the seats has more votes than the first vote getter for the second seat. And so the argument will be, well, the people wanted this other guy who's not even, you know what I'm saying? Like, it could get convoluted pretty quickly.
It'd be interesting to see if this is, yeah, if this has ever happened.
I don't know that it has. Anywhere, I mean, yeah, that's something we should definitely look up. There's another question I have here related to this that I didn't have time to look up today. We're going to look it up live on the air momentarily. In fact, let's get a little bit further down the line here and see if we can get to it. Continuing with the Star Tribune and their reporting regarding Governor Dayton's task that he has before him in the wake of Al Franken resigning. They quote him as saying, "I won't have any comments on it," that being the replacement for Al Franken, "until I have an announcement to make. It will be in a couple of days, and that's where I'm going to leave it for now," Dayton told reporters Friday morning after he spoke at a Final Four-related event in Minneapolis. Smith, Tina Smith, the lieutenant governor, was declining interview requests on Friday, and she backed out of a public appearance she'd been scheduled to make, as well as several more early next week. Democratic sources previously told the Star Tribune that Smith is Dayton's likeliest choice. She's a longtime DFL insider and trusted ally to Dayton. Even if Dayton picks her and she decides to run in 2018, there's no guarantee she won't face other high-profile DFL challengers. And Republicans are already viewing the seat as a pickup opportunity given the circumstances around Franken's exit. And, you know, it would be really interesting if they expounded upon that here. Like, obviously, they've talked to somebody, or maybe they haven't. Maybe they're just looking at Twitter and deriving that statement from there, and they're reporting at the Star Tribune. I don't know. It would be good to know, because to my knowledge, I haven't heard any scuttlebutt regarding people who are talking about running to fill this seat, to go against whoever Dayton appoints, and to try to seek Franken's seat in 2018. Continuing at the Star Tribune, if Smith gets the nod, this is the interesting part for the immediate future. Her departure would set off a series of changes mandated by state law. Under Minnesota's constitution, a vacancy in the lieutenant governor's office must be filled by the, quote, last presiding elected officer of the Senate, unquote. That means Smith would be replaced by Senate President Michelle Fischbach, a Republican from Painesville who has served in the legislature for two decades. Fischbach said Friday that she, along with many of her colleagues in the legislature, have found themselves in the unexpected position of needing to comb through state statutes and century-old court cases to sort out their potential political futures. It's an interesting time right now with this because everybody's pulling out their copy of the Constitution, she said. Fischbach said the law is clear that she's the first in line to succeed Smith should the lieutenant governor resign. Now, that's interesting, because you very well could have a situation here where if Dayton appoints Tina Smith, a Democrat from his party, to be the sit-in senator, the acting senator in the wake of Al Franken's resignation, that by state law, through no fault of his own, he ends up with a lieutenant governor from the other party, a Republican. Now, that's interesting only to the extent that we understand what it is that the lieutenant governor of Minnesota does. And I don't understand what the lieutenant governor for Minnesota does. So this was my question. I had a little note for myself to try to look this up, and I didn't quite get to it before the show started, so we're going to do it here live on the air. First of all, there is kind of a little blurb that comes up when you Google duties of Minnesota lieutenant governor. The lieutenant governor serves as a key member of the governor's cabinet and is involved in major policy and budget decisions. Well, that sounds pretty important. I don't know how you're going to manage to finagle that with somebody from the other party. Additionally, as lieutenant governor, the lieutenant governor serves as a member of the Minnesota Executive Council, whatever that is, and chairs the Capital Area Architectural Planning Board, whatever that is. Okay, and then we go here to Ballotopedia, where this information is coming from. And they talk a little bit about what's going to happen with vacancies, which is what we're talking about here with the potential appointment of Tina Smith to replace Al Franken. From Ballotopedia, the last elected presiding officer of the Senate shall become lieutenant governor in case a vacancy occurs in that office. In case the governor is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the same devolves on the lieutenant governor. The legislature may provide by law for the case of the removal, death, resignation, or inability of both the governor and lieutenant governor to discharge the duties of governor, and may provide by law for continuity of government in periods of emergency resulting from disasters caused by enemy attack, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So clear as mud in terms of how that whole process worked. But, you know, the relevant part here being what was quoted in the Star Tribune, that the last elected presiding officer of the Senate shall become lieutenant governor in case a vacancy occurs. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Another headline that I've seen as I've been scrolling through my news feed on social media. The beauty of the news feed, your Facebook news feed, your Twitter feed, what have you, is that it's kind of like those jelly beans from Harry Potter. You know, the ones that had every imaginable flavor possible. So, you know, one could be raspberry, another could be cherry, another could be chocolate, and then all of a sudden you just get poop. Like, poop-flavored jelly bean. That's what your news feed is like. And, you know, one of those less than desirable flavors that have come up in my newsfeed is this recurring headline about the gal who's getting engaged to her chandelier. I haven't been inclined to actually click on any of these and read the body to determine whether or not this is real or if there's any case law or any sort of statutory issues involved with the gal who wants to marry her chandelier. But, you know, why not? Love is love, right? Love is love. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Let's go to Don in Maple Grove. Welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. You know, my take on this is Al Franken has now been unshackled of all his, you know, lewd behavior and senatorial responsibilities. He's going to be much more aggressive on whoever is running on the Republican side in Minnesota. And he's going to come at him. He's going to pull a Roy Moore on everybody that's looking to run. And that's what he's getting ready to do. That's probably going to be his legacy for the rest of his life now, because he's been shamed so much, he's going to have to retrieve it somehow. That's who we need to, that's what we need to worry about if Republican candidate is running in Minnesota.
So,
and also,
okay, continue.
I heard Lori Swanson is his name being talked about, and she's pretty, she doesn't have any baggage. Looks like she might be a pretty popular candidate.
Yeah, she's a god awful public official, but,
she's the election commissioner, right?
Isn't she attorney general? Yeah, she's attorney general.
Attorney General, yeah, that's right, yeah.
And in
so
that,
I don't know her record, but then that her name is being thrown around. Well, I didn't see any bad things about her in the news, so I don't know
much
about her.
She's one of these people. We've had Harry Niska when he was lined up to seek the Republican endorsement to run for Attorney General, who came in and talked to us pretty extensively about Lori Swanson. And her deal is she's kind of similar. She's kind of to the Attorney General's office what Amy Klobuchar is to the Senate, in that she goes after cases in her role that are going to be non-controversial, that present the least amount of political risk, and make her look good. So instead of actually doing her job.
Whoever is running for the Republican candidacy in Minnesota, you do have a real good shot at it, except that person, he or she, has to have a delicate balance between getting too close to Trump. And I'm a Trump supporter, but also in this state, and also looking out for the average guy. And that's a delicate balance. I hope somebody comes around and does that.
I appreciate your call, Don. Thanks for joining the program. Yeah, I don't know that that's a balance that's possible. And I think to the extent that we've seen candidates try to walk a tightrope between being with Trump and for Trump and not, they have failed miserably. Because what ends up happening is people on both sides of that divide call them out as a fraud. Rightfully so. I mean, there really is no... neutral ground. You can't sit on the fence when it comes to Trump. And, you know, I had a caller last night who acknowledged or recognized that I attempted my analysis of Trump to be fair and to call balls and strikes and to appraise him when he does things that are good, along with the criticism that I offer against him. But when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, you're either a Trump supporter or you're not. and I remain in the not category. And you gotta pick a side. And I'm in the not a Trump supporter side at this point. So in a similar sense, whoever the candidate is for this or any other race going into 2018, they're going to be asked that question of where do you stand on Trump? They're going to be asked it by Trump supporters, and they're going to be asked it by everybody else. And a clear answer is going to be expected. You're not going to be able to, you know, come up with some sort of word salad that satisfies people without actually committing one way or the other. So going back to this question of what happens now in the wake of Al Franken resigning, when Mark Dayton appoints somebody to fill that role, what happens if he appoints his lieutenant governor, Tina Smith? And the answer is, according to the Minnesota Constitution, that the last elected presiding officer of the Senate shall become lieutenant governor. Well, in this case, that happens to be a Republican. And so what is it that the lieutenant governor does? Well, again, looking at Ballotopedia, the lieutenant governor serves as a key member of the governor's cabinet and is involved in major policy and budget decisions. Additionally, as lieutenant governor, the lieutenant governor serves as a member of the Minnesota State Executive Council and chairs the Capital Area Architectural Planning Board. So you're involved in, I don't know, that's like a statewide planning commission. That sounds horrible. That sounds god-awful. Minnesota's lieutenant governor serves as an extension of the governor and assists the governor in carrying out the functions of the executive branch. The lieutenant governor represents the governor and is prepared to act in the governor's place in the event of his or her absence. So this would be awkward if a Republican, if Fischbach, ends up being the new lieutenant governor of Minnesota. This next year is going to be an awkward one in the executive branch for Governor Dayton, which really isn't, you know, it's Governor Dayton's entire administration has been awkward, but this is going to ratchet it up a notch in terms of the awkward factor, having to contend with a lieutenant governor from the other party. Now, there are things that he can do to mitigate that. The last paragraph here says that the governor may delegate to the lieutenant governor any powers, duties, responsibilities, or functions as prescribed by law. And so the reverse of that is also true. Like, he can just basically leave her as a figurehead and not let her do anything, which is probably the most likely way that things are going to proceed here. Speaking of Tina Smith, from the Star Tribune, Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton's top pick to fill Senator Al Franken's seat, Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith. Usually I save the pop culture, entertainment, movies, television stuff for later on a Friday evening, but I'm going to lead off with it today because there's a couple things that have me having opposite emotional reactions. On the one end, I'm very cognizant of the fact that at this point, 1 week from today, I will have seen Star Wars The Last Jedi. It's happening. Like, I'm so busy. I'm from the time I wake up, from the moment I wake up until the moment I go to bed, there's like this constant state of urgency with all the things that I do with my day job and preparing for the show and doing this show and, you know, doing family stuff and taking care of the kids and what have you. There's this constant state of urgency that leaves me incapable of really thinking too much or too often about what I'm going to do tomorrow or next week or whatever the case may be. But we're now so close to it, to Star Wars coming out, that it's starting to enter my consciousness and I'm becoming aware of, wow, I'm actually going to go see this movie. Tickets already bought, getting off work early on Friday. I mean, I'm going all out, getting the kid off the bus, racing to the theater. Like, it's happening.
We're replaying the show.
Yeah, we're doing a show replay. We're not going to be here Friday night. So, you know, I hope you like the best of that we play on that evening because I got to see my Star Wars. So that's the one thing that has me happy. But coupled alongside that, dragging me in the other direction, pop culture-wise, this is a real headline, what I'm about to say to you. A new Star Trek movie is in development to be directed by Quentin Tarantino. And it is going to be rated R. Like, when I saw this, and I saw it on a source that I trust, so I wanted to disbelieve it, but I trust the source. And so I thought, oh my God, this is real. This is happening. Star Trek is in some ways, now you might think that Star Wars is no good, that Brad thinks that the franchise has gone in a bad direction, that Disney's shepherding it to its doom. I disagree. I think that the general public perception of Star Wars is that it's doing pretty well. Certainly it's making a lot of money. Star Trek is going in the opposite direction with this new Discovery that they have on their CBS All Access. And even though, yes, I went on my screed about the whole All Access thing or CBS Access, whatever the service is called, I have to confess I have watched the show, the first half of the season, which I'm actually glad about because now I can say with authority that it's a crappy show. Like, it's not a good show. Like, it could be a good show for what it is onto itself, but it's not a good Star Trek show. Like, it's a complete bastardization of everything that Star Trek was back in the day. And I'm by no means one of these purists, you know, one of these convention attending, you know, uber nerds who thinks that, oh, you got the color of his shirt wrong, or the logo was a millimeter too small, and heresy. Like, that's not the kind of thing I'm talking about. I'm talking about things like the general philosophy of the show, the nature of the characters, the themes, like the spirit of it is all wrong in this new television series. And it looks like that's the direction they're heading with the movies too. You know, when you're going to have Quentin Tarantino basically do his whole, you know, The Bride, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown thing in the Star Trek universe. Like, it'd be one thing if it was a spoof, if he's like, oh, I'm going to do a Star Trek style movie my way. That would be fun. But to actually make it official canon Star Trek, pretty ridiculous.
Well, it is interesting because, I mean, granted, I don't know much of anything about Star Trek. I watched Star Wars growing up, but there is a positive and a negative, I think, to Quentin Tarantino. Like, hearing the name Quentin Tarantino associated with Star Trek, it's kind of like when you see one of those pictures online of, like, a really gross food combination.
Right.
Like, recently, it was that picture of Pop-Tarts and cheese, right, that a college student from Iowa tweeted out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's initially, like, that was my initial reaction. Like, oh, that's just a bad combination. But thinking about Quentin Tarantino's other movies, for example, Django Unchained,
mm-hmm,
he took a classic concept of a Western,
right,
but put a new spin on it, and right, it was really good.
Sure.
He took the black anti-hero, just the brutalization of slavery,
right,
and turned it on its head.
Right.
So it might be okay. It's possible that it will be okay.
Sure, but with that, with Django Unchained, he created a brand within a genre, right? So he didn't go and remake, I don't know, what's a famous Western? I don't know. He didn't go remake some classic Western and call it that and call the characters those names and then completely bastardize the spirit of what that particular story was. So it'd be one thing if he said, hey, I'm going to make a movie and it's going to be a space exploration movie about Star Trek-like, and it's going to be called whatever he calls it, and it's a Quentin Tarantino movie that's in that genre. That would be one thing, and I would actually be kind of excited about that because, oh, what's this going to be like? This is different for him because he's done all that's one genre he has not touched, right? And he is a Star Trek fan. He had, if you recall, in front of Kill Bill, one of the opening quote was from Wrath of Khan or whatever. So, I mean, he's a well-known Star Trek fan. I trust that he could bring something to that genre, but for him to do Star Trek, I agree with your initial comparison. It's like mixing a gross food combination. It's not that I don't like Pop-Tarts. It's not that I don't like cheese. I just don't want cheese on my Pop-Tarts, right? It's not that I don't like Quentin Tarantino. It's not that I don't like Star Trek. I just don't want Quentin Tarantino directing my Star Trek. That's the situation that I find myself in right now. So, had to get that off my chest to start the program.
Well, having never watched Star Trek, I might be persuaded to watch this movie because Quentin Tarantino's directing it.
Well, there you go. So, maybe that's what it's all about. Maybe it's about starting things pushing things in a new direction and what have you. And that, I would argue that J.J. Abrams already kind of did that because his movies, to my mind and to a lot of fans' minds, really don't fit with the spirit of what Star Trek was originally either, but this is taking it to a whole new level, having Quentin Tarantino do it. All right, Closing Argument is the name of our program. My name's Walter Hudson. That's Brad Omlin, who produces the show. 651-989-5855 is the number if you want to join us and chime in your anticipation of Star Wars or your reaction to Quentin Tarantino directing Star Trek. All things nerdy this evening. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app, two ways to stream this program. You can also catch up on podcasts of past shows by doing a search for Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app. We appreciate you joining us. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. So, to get back onto politics, to get back onto the political news, the cultural news, we've been talking about the resignation of Senator Al Franken and the kind of the procedural curiosity that that's triggering with Governor Mark Dayton poised to appoint a replacement, and the good money is on it being his Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith, and that in turn is going to trigger the automatic statutory appointment of a Republican. I can't remember her first name, but Fishbach is the last name, who's constitutionally mandated as the replacement for the Lieutenant Governor in the event of a vacancy. That's all well and good. That's all interesting. But of course, the sexier analysis of the Al Franken story is what it signals for the political future of both of these parties, what it signals for the 2018 election, and how what it is enabled in terms of rhetorical claims from various figures in the discourse. As an example of that, or for an example of that, we turn to the Daily Wire. On Thursday's broadcast of MSNBC's Hardball, host Chris Matthews offered his own addled positive spin from the fallout after the resignation of Minnesota Senator Al Franken, saying, "The worst thing you can say about Democrats is they're too pure." This is your unbiased, objective newsman here. Matthews commented, quote, "I don't know how you can avoid the education in this. The worst you can say about Democrats is they're too pure. And that's a stupid thing to say, but that's the worst thing you can say about them. These guys set too high a standard for public office. How's that for an argument? My opponents, the party of my opposition, they set too high a standard. You know, come on, what do you think?" I don't even understand where Matthews is going towards the end of that, but you get the general idea. Now, this guy, Jason Johnson, again, this being relayed to us from The Wire, The Daily Wire, this guy, Jason Johnson of The Root, responded to what Matthews had to say, and he kind of upped the ante a little bit. He said, "Voters don't like parties that aren't consistent. They don't trust you when you preach one thing and your policy is something else. So for the Democratic Party to say, hey, look, not only are we complaining about the war against women, not only are we going to be the party that represents women's issues economically and policy-wise, we're going to hold our party to that standard. I think it increases enthusiasm. It makes people much more happy about the party. It may not bring any Republicans over, but it will certainly make Democrats much happier, and they can bring some attention and some excitement to what might be Keith Ellison or the woman Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota running for that position." So there you go. The claim here by Jason Johnson of The Root and by Chris Matthews of MSNBC is that the Democrats are pure as the driven snow, and the resignation of Al Franken proves it.
Well, and back to our discussion last hour about who is elected, because we're going to have both Senate seats up for election. We're discussing the dilemma of federalism and the Constitution that this creates. And I've been looking online, and I found a board on a website called straightdope.com. I've never heard of that, but but the discussion on here does seem legit, because sure, it doesn't devolve, and it actually does seem to be based in reason. And it says here that, like, when a new state is admitted to the union, senators get appointed until, like, say one got appointed this year, one would run again in 2018, and then one would run again in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And it's saying here that Al Franken would have been up for re-election in 2020, right? And then after 2018, Amy Klobuchar will be up for election again in 2024.
Right.
So there will be two seats open, and I would assume Amy Klobuchar, and then they'll but then there'll be one for the short term and one for the long term. So I assume Amy Klobuchar would run for her 6-year seat again.
Correct.
But then another senator, another candidate, will run for the 4-year seat until 2020.
Right. So basically they're running for not even a half, a third of a term in 2018. Because... No.
Or yeah, I suppose.
Right, because in 2020 is when Franken would have faced election.
Yeah.
So his elected replacement will be determined in 2018, but that person will only be senator for 2 years before they have to run again. It'll be like a House situation, which, you know, is going to kind of handicap them, I imagine, in terms of being able to serve the Senate role. Because the reason why senators have longer terms is because their role is supposed to function differently than the House. They're not supposed to be, freed up to act more deliberately as opposed to being subject to the political winds.
The Senate is the plate on which the teacup cools, as my political science professor in college said.
There you go. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. That's Brad Ullman, produces the show. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can join us tonight, 651-989-5855. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So I'm just kind of making the show up as I go tonight. It's not that I didn't prep. It's that as we're going to breaks here, I find myself Googling things that, you know, change my mind as to what I want to talk about. And I found an article here from The Nation that fits really well with this other one from The Week that I pulled earlier in the evening. The Democrats, the way the Democrats are reacting, and we kind of talked about it a little bit earlier in the last segment when we cited Chris Matthews and a gentleman from The Root who are suddenly declaring that the Democratic Party has the moral high ground because Al Franken resigned, that they're pure as the driven snow, that they're, as Chris Matthews put it, they're too pure, right? They're too pure because they actually are holding their own accountable in the case of Al Franken. They're really basking in this delusion that they have a standard when it comes to sexual behavior. And I want to spend a little time marinating in that before I hit you with the punchline over there at the Daily Wire regarding this. To start off, let's go to this article that I found in The Nation. By the way, this closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can join us at 651-989-5855. This is written by a Joan Walsh. And I'm going to try to scroll down here to where she starts to make her case. She says she would like to see Franken's departure be not just another hashtag MeToo moment, but a long-delayed hashtag Trump2 moment. Now that Franken has left the building, why can't the Democratic senators who've asked him to resign, an astonishing 35 out of a 48-member caucus, now commit to holding hearings on Trump's many sexual abuse accusations? A Quinnipiac poll out Wednesday shows that 70% of Americans polled say they want Congress to investigate the allegations against Trump. Only 25% are opposed. Now, I want to see that poll. I want to see how that question was provided there, because that seems ridiculous that 70% of Americans want Congress to waste time investigating sexual assault allegations that were already adjudicated by last year's election. Obviously, nobody cared, or at least enough people didn't care for it to affect the last year's election, but suddenly we need to have hearings about it now. Continuing at The Nation. Given that Trump's pathetic, and again, this is Joan Walsh, given that Trump's pathetic approval ratings normally show him with the backing of 35 to 40% of those polled, this means a significant number of Trump supporters also want these charges investigated, or it suggests that the poll is screwy, but whatever. She concedes that Democrats are in the minority in both houses of Congress. Such hearings would hold limited power, but even in the minority, ranking congressional Democrats can still get congressional hearing rooms and media attention. They won't have subpoena power, but they don't need subpoena power to call Trump's victims to testify. I would like to see the Democrats get more aggressive with Trump because they need to be honest with themselves about what Franken's resignation will not do. It will not force GOP leaders to concede that Democrats have integrity when it comes to these claims and that Republicans don't. And then she goes on to try to make that case. Now, and she also says here, which I think is interesting, she says that serial prevaricator Sarah Huckabee Sanders has already explained that the difference between Franken and Trump is that Franken admitted something happened and apologized while Trump denied all charges against him. Now, this is interesting because there is actually something to this. And that's what transitions us over here to the week. There's an analysis here that suggests, and I think rightly, that the way to predict the outcome, the political outcome of allegations of sexual misconduct is if the person admits to it at all, they are going down. Even if it's a wishy-washy, flippy-floppy, you know, kind of muddled, tongue-tied admission such as the one Al Franken gave, you're on the path to being out. If, on the contrary, you insist that the accusations are lies, that you've done nothing wrong, and, you know, hold your ground, then you're going to survive. And that's the case that's made here at The Week, written by a Paul Waldman. In January 1992, a woman named Jennifer Flowers held a press conference in which she claimed that she had a years-long affair with Bill Clinton, who was then leading the race to be the Democratic nominee for president. At the time, I was working for one of Clinton's rivals, and I called up a good friend of mine who was on Clinton's staff just to gloat. He sighed heavily and said, to be honest, Jennifer Flowers may be the only woman in Arkansas Bill Clinton hasn't slept with. As it turns out, we were both wrong. I was wrong because, along with everyone else, I thought the scandal would torpedo Clinton's campaign, and my friend was wrong because Clinton later admitted that he had, in fact, slept with Flowers, though he denied a long affair. But 25 years later, we're seeing the lesson of that campaign and Bill Clinton's subsequent history play out yet again. When it comes to sex scandals, the politicians who are the most guilty and the least repentant are the ones who survive. Senator Al Franken of Minnesota is expected to announce his resignation on Thursday after two more allegations of inappropriate sexual behavior were published on Wednesday and most of his Democratic colleagues in the Senate called for him to step down. If that is indeed what happens, and of course it has since this writing, it will be a turn of events that is at once rare. Senators very seldom voluntarily give up their seats for any reason, let alone for allegations that haven't been proven in court, and unsurprising if you understand how scandals like this usually proceed. That's because Franken was contrite and apologetic when the allegations first emerged. When he said in general terms that he didn't remember events in the same way his accusers did, he didn't attack them or call them liars, and he pledged to do better. When a politician reacts that way, there's a good chance he's on his way out. And who survives this kind of scandal? The ones that are the least repentant and often the most guilty. Clinton is a perfect example. When Flowers made her allegation, he undertook one of the most epic damage control operations in American political history. He said Flowers wasn't telling the truth and arranged a high-stakes interview on 60 Minutes in which he and his wife Hillary defended the state of their marriage. "I have acknowledged wrongdoing. I have acknowledged causing pain in my marriage," he said, but steadfastly refused to answer specific questions about how he had done so. Never for a moment did he consider leaving the race. He just kept fighting, and he won the primaries and then the general election.
Well, there, and to your point here, the point of that article, there was an article here in the Wall Street Journal earlier this week that talked about Roy Moore's liberal enablers, and it goes through the cases of Bill Clinton, Doug Jones, Al Franken, and then people like Jimmy Kimmel and the National Press Corps who defend them.
Right.
And it says, like, and to the point, like, they don't admit it, so they keep on, as Bill Clinton did.
Keep on keeping on.
Yeah. And so it says here, then liberals wonder at a CBS poll finding that 71% of Alabama Republicans don't believe the allegations of their candidate. They may well be wrong about Mr. Moore and his accusers, but is their skepticism really that difficult to understand? If Mr. Moore does find himself Alabama's newest senator next Tuesday night, it may be as much of the fault as those who opposed him as those who supported him.
There you go. And that brings us to, you know, the punchline here over the Daily Wire. You have Democrats who are trying to portray themselves, portray their party as somehow pure as the driven snow and resting upon the moral high ground with hands planted firmly on waist in a Superman pose. You know, they're just the best ever, right? Because Al Franken resigned. When this analysis, which, by the way, from a liberal, right, from a Democratic operative, this analysis suggests that the resignation of Franken has nothing whatsoever to do with Democratic morality and everything to do with the kind of sociology of admitting that you've done something wrong rather than standing your ground. Now, this author over here at the Daily Wire, Hank Barron, has the punchline here. He says, yep, the same party that idolized sexual harassers, philanderers, and abusers from JFK to Teddy Kennedy to Bill Clinton turned a blind eye to harassers such as John Conyers suddenly has morphed into a party that is consistent because Franken resigned. In truth, the Democratic Party was more consistent before Franken resigned. They have been blindly obedient to men mistreating women since the days of FDR dallying with Lucy Mercer and his wife Eleanor was gallivanting about. For them to suddenly discover the virtues of men treating women with grace is highly inconsistent with their past behavior, and that is, of course, objectively true. It's objectively true. Democrats have a short-term memory of about 5 minutes right now and are reveling in a pretended moral high ground. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So now that we've established this hypothesis that I think is pretty accurate, that the outcome of being accused of sexual misconduct really depends almost exclusively on whether or not you admit you did something. Like, if you say, eh, they're all liars, none of it happened, I'm pure as the driven snow, and I'm awesome, and you should vote for me, then you're going to survive. But if you say, yeah, I did it, you know, in Louis C.K. fashion, or you muddle about like Al Franken and say, well, you know, women should be believed, but I don't quite recall what happened, and yada, 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 you're on your way out. Right. That's the thesis that was drawn out for us by a Democratic operative of all people, writing for, I believe it was The Week.
It's very Machiavellian.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something to it. In that context, let's take a look at what Trump was doing this evening in Pensacola, Florida, which just so happens to be within a very short driving distance of Alabama. I'm sure that's entirely coincidental, seeing as how they have a key Senate election taking place in just a few days. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. You can join us this evening, 651-989-5855. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the program.
Well, and don't forget, too, that next Tuesday, we will be live.
Yes,
we'll have the chance to react to Roy Moore's potential election.
Yes, we will. And we'll be looking forward to that, looking forward to your reactions. I have a feeling that my reaction and your reaction, Brad, is going to be a little bit different than many of our listeners.
Well, my reaction, like, I'm going to be ambivalent either way.
Yeah.
I think, really. It's, again, like,
that's probably the healthiest place to be.
Yeah.
That's probably the healthiest place to be. That I can't quite conjure ambivalence. Sometimes I'm good at it, but you know, it's not really, when I'm behind this mic, it's not really a place that I'm supposed to be, so it's probably not going to happen on Tuesday. Just to give you a little warning there. All right, from the Star Tribune, President Donald Trump on Friday urged voters to elect a Republican Senate candidate in Alabama who has been dogged by allegations of sexual misconduct, warning that America cannot afford to have a Democrat win the hard-fought campaign instead. Trump gave a boost to the campaign of GOP Senate candidate Roy Moore during a raucous campaign rally in the Florida panhandle near the state line with Alabama. Get out and vote for Roy Moore. Do it. Do it. Trump told the crowd. Man, he was not being ambivalent. This is the weird thing, and there might be an answer to this question, and they hint at it later here in the article. Obviously, by going to Pensacola, and you know the administration denies this, but come on, let's not be... Don't insult our intelligence. The reason for going to Pensacola is so that you can basically have an Alabama election rally without being in Alabama. Like, that's the point of doing it. Now, is the reason why he did that because there's some sort of legal issue? I can't imagine there's any sort of legal problem with him going to Alabama if he wants to go to Alabama to campaign for Roy Moore directly. I mean, the president could do that.
I figured he was just going to Florida to golf.
That's probably a fair. Is there with it? Yeah, that might be something worth looking into. But it's just, on the one hand, it's really odd, first of all, that he did this in this way, that he went to Pensacola in order to campaign for Roy Moore, essentially. Essentially, that's what he did. But to do that and then deny that that's what he's doing, and then, after denying that that's what he's doing, to say, quote, get out and vote for Roy Moore, do it. It's like, what? Like, are you trying to be covert or not? Because, and if you're not, which he's clearly not trying to be covert, because he's saying go out and vote for Roy Moore, why not just go to Alabama and make it explicit?
Well, I think it's just because it's a major city. Like, the Pensacola DMA, I know, the direct market area, extends into Alabama.
Right.
So, it's not that there isn't an Alabama audience in Pensacola, or, mm-hmm. like, somebody from Alabama wouldn't drive to Pensacola.
Well, sure, no, I think that's a given, that's built into why they went to Pensacola. But I guess what I'm asking is that the best place? Like, was going to Pensacola the best bang for your buck if you're actually trying to affect the election on Tuesday in Alabama? I got to imagine that you'd have more of an impact if you were actually in Alabama in a major metropolitan area there.
Maybe
not. I don't know. It'd be good to find out.
I mean, half of it could just be about the money, too. They know there's more money in Pensacola, so they can raise money for Roy Moore in his final week.
So, continuing, you know, moving past that point, Trump continued, we cannot afford, and this again from the Star Tribune, we cannot afford, the future of this country cannot afford to lose the seat, Trump said, referring to the party's razor-thin 52-48 advantage in that chamber of Congress. Trump said Moore's opponent, Doug Jones, is a liberal Democrat who would be completely controlled by Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi in the House and Chuck Schumer in the Senate. He's their total puppet and everybody knows it, Trump said during a wide-ranging speech that included riffs on the U.S. immigration system and the nation's economic performance since he took office. He touched briefly on the closely watched Senate race that will be decided when voters in next-door Alabama go to the polls Tuesday. He said, quote, we need somebody in that Senate seat who will vote for our Make America Great Again agenda, which involves tough on crime, strong on borders, strong on immigration. As Trump spoke about Moore tweeted Trump's comments to his own followers. So, you know, gone is any ambivalence regarding, you know, where Trump stands on Roy Moore, which, you know, I actually appreciate. I'm going to tell you the truth. I'm not big on this whole, we talked about fence sitting earlier in the program as it regards to whether you support Trump or don't support Trump and how there's been candidates who tried to have it both ways and how that doesn't really work out too well. You can't be like, well, I like Trump for X, Y, and Z, but I question A, B, and C. Like you're going to get called out by everybody for not taking a stance one way or the other on Trump. Roy Moore is the exact same way. Like you got to be for him or against him, and you can't try to muddy the waters. And for a long time early on, it seemed as though the White House was trying to muddy the waters as to whether or not they were backing Moore. So at least they're making the decision that they're going to throw their stake in 110%. So,
well, I mean, even if Roy Moore is wishy-washy about Trump, the fact that he has Trump's endorsement now, I think, says a lot.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, at this point, it doesn't matter whether or not he likes Trump because Trump is on his side.
So another point that Trump raised during his rally in Pensacola earlier this evening is echoed here and expounded upon at the Washington Times. One of the women accusing Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore of sexual misconduct when he was a prosecutor and she was a teen admitted to fabricating part of the evidence she provided to back her story, ABC News reported Friday. Beverly Young Nelson had offered her yearbook up as proof she and Moore interacted decades ago, but on Friday she admitted to adding to the signature in her yearbook. Ms. Nelson said she only added the date and place, stressing Mr. Moore still signed her yearbook. He did sign it, Ms. Nelson told ABC News. Gloria Allred, Ms. Nelson's lawyer, said at a news conference Friday that she had forensic document expert Arthur Anthony analyzed the signature and confirmed it is Mr. Moore's writing. Members of Mr. Moore's campaign called on Ms. Allard, or Allred, to release the yearbook at a press event Friday afternoon. They want to have the yearbook examined and test the ink to see if it was written when Ms. Nielsen claims or more recently. Really, really dumb. Really, really dumb on her part. Because it, what it does, and Trump, you know, used this in his remarks at the rally tonight, is it provides a wedge that people were desperately looking for to completely discredit the entire story. And to basically say, see? It's all fake. It's all fake news. Now, of course, two things, again, you know, this is something we keep coming back to again and again on the program. Two things can be true at once. It can be true that she added to and therefore falsified part of this evidence that she offered up. And it can also be true that he did sign the yearbook and that the other thing she talked about did occur. But unfortunately, in the court of public opinion, in the minds of the individual voter making their decision, none of that is going to matter. None of that nuance is going to matter. Again, you know, there's no fence sitting here. You're either on one side or the other, and this is going to calcify those who were ready to completely write off her accusation and the accusations of others. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Little diversity here on the program. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. Diversity, you know, is one of these words. There's a whole list. One of my book ideas, it just came to me, a book idea, would be to just go through the language and the political discourse that we have and write chapters on different words that are used and just analyze how they're used.
It'd be a good book.
You know what I'm saying? Why? Because it's taken for granted. When you evoke the word diversity, that means something. It conjures something in people's heads that I maintain for a lot of folks is completely invalid and inaccurate. You know, the idea that there's some sort of value in mere difference. Look, there's value in expanding your horizons. There's value in knowing as much as you possibly can, in exposing yourself to different cultures and different ideas and different philosophies and worldviews and what have you, to being educated, right? So in that sense, diversity absolutely is a good thing. But the notion that in the way to make something better is to just throw a minority at it. You know what I'm saying? Like, if we could just... The way to make this institution better is to just sprinkle some black, to just, you know, kind of include a little bit of Native American, right? If we could just throw some LGBT in there, it's just gonna be better. Automatically, it's just gonna be better because it's gonna be more diverse. And diversity has become this primary measure of value that we just inherently know that things are good based upon the variety of colors in a given room. It's a pretty absurd notion. And it's one that Representative Steve King, a Republican from Iowa, has the audacity to identify as such. And we have an article here in The Hill that I want to get to. But before we do, I, of course, have to go to Abdi in St. Paul, who I know is going to have some interesting insight on this concept. How are you doing tonight, Abdi? Do I got you? Oh, you back on hold? Are you on?
Yep, I'm on.
Okay, how's it going? Gotcha. Just having some button issues here tonight. It's a Friday.
No problem. Yeah, I was just listening into what you were talking about right now about diversity, and I think maybe you're getting into what Steve King was,
yes,
the outrage was about what Steve King said or what he tweeted,
yep,
out. Is that,
mm-hmm,
what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep. And for me, I immediately was talking about this to somebody in a thread on Twitter, but there's a difference of cultural diversity and ethnic diversity, right? I don't think he was talking about there's a problem with ethnic diversity, but when you mix cultures, in a way of saying mixing values, culture is, you know, values,
right,
is the same thing. And when you have cultures that, and by the way, I'm Somali, I'm Muslim, and, you know, there's stuff that people, I mean, the alt-right or whatever people will say, there's no similarities at all between Muslims and the West. I say there's some congruencies, a lot of congruencies, with Judeo-Christian values.
Well, and before you go any further, I have no doubt that your analysis on that front is profoundly more nuanced and educated than that of anybody on the alt-right, but go ahead.
Exactly. So, and what I was saying was, there can be people from India, there can be people from Latin America. We will have different cultural values, and what we're seeing around the world, yeah, like you said, like just throwing a minority at something doesn't change the situation, doesn't change, it doesn't fix the problem immediately, and that's it's a warped mindset of thinking.
So
I just wanted to chime in on that, but also, I mean, I don't want to produce the show or anything, but going back to the Roy Moore stuff, I think there's a lot to say about fake news. I don't know if you guys mentioned the CNN debacle that happened today with...
It's on my list, but go right ahead.
No, I was just saying, you know, the media is really just doing a number on themselves. I don't think Trump has any, you know, he doesn't have to do much. He just has to sit back and let their hysteria kind of have them unravel themselves pretty much. But I just want to mention those couple of things. So
I appreciate your call, Abdi, as always. And we do got to get around to having you in just to kind of focus on talking about your experience as a Somali Muslim Trump supporter here in the United States.
I would love to anytime.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks. We'll follow up. All right. So we're not going to have time to get into it quite the way that I want to here, but I can kind of preview it for you here a little bit. And Abdi brought it up, that this outrage over a tweet by Steve King. It's reported on over here at The Hill. Representative Steve King said that diversity is not America's strength in a pair of tweets Friday. King linked to an article by The Voice of Europe Friday that quoted Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban saying that cultures shouldn't be mixed, arguing that it's against common sense. King tweeted the story with the message, "Diversity is not our strength. Assimilation has become a dirty word to the multicultural left. Assimilation, not diversity, is our American strength," he tweeted. King, one of the most vocal critics of immigration in Congress, has made controversial statements in the past, including praise for far-right European politician Geert Wilders. He tweeted a cartoon of Wilders plugging a hole in a wall that read Western Civilization in March. Wilders understands that culture and demographics are our destiny. We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies, King wrote at the time. Now, I remember that controversy because that was right after we first came on the air with Closing Argument back in, what was it, February, March, in that zone, where this was the controversy when he was talking about other people's babies and what that meant. And of course, the left automatically characterizes that in the worst possible way imaginable, right? That he's coming out against black babies, he's coming out against Muslim babies, whatever the case may be. But I took his point to be at the time, and just like with this most recent tweet, to be exactly what Abdi was talking about, which is that he's talking about culture. He's not talking about ethnicity. He's not talking about skin color. He's not talking about race. He's talking about culture. He's saying you cannot have a situation where your culture is not being perpetrated or I can't think of the right word, but it's not being shared. It's not being pushed forward into the future. It's not being propagated. That's the word that I'm looking for. You can't have a scenario like that and then expect your culture to survive. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. It's just, it's such a like the word itself has become practically useless, you know, like you can't even evoke it without it triggering a flood of fallacious ideas that completely confuscate or, you know, completely muddy the waters in terms of being able to proceed with any sort of intelligent, rational conversation. Diversity. We're going to talk about it here tonight on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you sticking with us on a Friday night. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app, two ways to stream us. You can catch up on the podcasts right there in your iHeartRadio app. Just do a search for Closing Argument. Our past programs will pop up. You can join us tonight as well. 651-989-5855. Don't feel beholden to the topic at hand. It's late on a Friday night. We will go anywhere you want to go in terms of topics this evening, anything that's been happening this week, this month, this year, as we move towards the end of the year, towards Christmas, towards New Year's. It hit me today. It's the 8th of December. It hit me today that it actually is winter, that it actually is December, that Christmas is upon us. It just kind of creeped up in my mind.
I mean, this year, I mean, I'm sure you feel the same way, too. Like, we're both working full-time and do this. Like, right. I remember when it was November, I, like, looked up and I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's November. Yeah. Where's this year gone?
Yeah, well, because we had a cold snap, right, where it snowed early, it got cold early. And so I kind of had it in the back of my head that the cold has come early. And then today I was driving around, walking around. I was thinking to myself, man, it's cold for this time of year. And then I remembered, I'm like, dummy, it's December. Like, it's December now. Like, this is what it's supposed to be. It was weird back in early November when it was this cold, right? But now this is something that you ought to be expecting at this point. But yeah, the end of the year is really creeping up on us quick. All right, so turning our attention back once again to Steve King and his comments regarding diversity. I want to try to recap a little bit here from The Hill. Steve King said that diversity is not America's strength in a pair of tweets Friday. He linked to an article by The Voice of Europe that quoted Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban saying that cultures shouldn't be mixed, arguing that it's against common sense. And that really is the cultures shouldn't be mixed. Is the key phrase here. Because, you know, like with an earlier tweet that got King into trouble earlier in the year when he talked about how, what is it here, talking about other people's babies, trying to find it because it really is. He was talking about Geert Wilders, and he said, Wilders understands that culture and demographics are our destiny. We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies. It strikes me as pretty clear, just given the grammatical construction of that statement, when he's saying we can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies, that is a reference to culture. It's not a reference to race. It's not a reference to color. He's not saying that we shouldn't have black people here or that we shouldn't have anybody who's a Muslim here or whatever the case may be. He's saying that the culture of the United States of America, Western civilization as such, and that which makes it different from the alternative, cannot be sustained if it is not perpetuated in children. If you have people coming here with other worldviews, other philosophies, and they're having a bunch of babies and teaching their babies those ideas, and they start to outnumber the natives, you got a problem in terms of preserving your culture.
Well, this happened in Roman mythology. The incident was called the Rape of the Sabine Women.
Yeah.
And basically the Romans realized that, oh, crap, we're not going to survive without kids. And so they basically took over. They basically tricked the Sabines to be friendly with them, mm-hmm. and then took over their culture by taking all the women.
A more modern, less sophisticated reference would be Prima Nocta. From Braveheart, the idea that in order to get the Scots out of Scotland, you're going to breed them out, right? You know, there's just scientifically, factually, that is a sound strategy, right? So, you know, to have concern about that is entirely rational. Now, I don't bring this up because I want to talk about Steve King. I bring it up because I want to point out the hypocrisy of a left side of the political spectrum that is pretending to be offended by this. And yes, I say pretending to be offended by it, because fundamentally they agree with what Steve King is saying, and I can prove it. From the Daily Mail, a sociology professor has claimed that white nuclear families with children are a form of white supremacy. Jesse Daniels, a self-proclaimed internationally recognized expert on internet manifestations of racism.
That's a thing?
You know, I don't know. Like, if you're going to self-proclaim your credential, I make it a little bit grander, a little bit more broad That seems really specific and irrelevant to everybody's day-to-day life. Internationally recognized expert on internet manifestations of racism.
Does that fit on your LinkedIn headline?
So this professor, Jesse Daniels, a woman at the City University of New York, made the controversial claim Wednesday on Twitter. This is from a couple of weeks back. She wrote, quote, "Part of what I've learned is that the white nuclear family is one of the most powerful forces supporting white supremacy," she opined in a tweet, which has since been deleted. Daniels went on to argue that forming a white family and having white children that you want the best for perpetuates racism and is part of the problem. The professor did not let multiracial families off the hook either, writing that any white person who has multiracial children without confronting your own racism or systemic white supremacy is not helping. Daniels spoke favorably of a feminist critique of the family as an inherently conservative force in society, lamenting, however, that it seemed to have fallen out of favor in academic circles due to the push for gay marriage. The molder of young minds then called on all white families to give away their family wealth and homes when they die. "White people, do you own your home?" she asked. "When you die, where's wealth in that house going? If it's to your children, you're reproducing inequality." Okay, so I bring this up, I bring this gal's point up to indicate to you, Do you recognize the similarity here? Do you recognize the through line between what Steve King is saying and what this gal is saying? She is saying, she's taking the other side of the coin of what Steve King is saying. Steve King is saying, hey, if we value our culture, if we value Western civilization, then we need to perpetuate that by having children, right? First of all, physically having kids, number one. And number two, bringing them up to adopt the same ideas that are that interweave into the bedrock of our culture, that form Western civilization. We need to perpetuate our culture. That is the case that he's making. And he's also saying that we need to be careful about how much we allow other cultures to intermingle with ours and overwhelm ours to the point where Western civilization no longer exists or starts to get overwhelmed. That's the point he's making. This professor on the left, the same left that says Steve King is a racist and a crazy person for asserting that, is taking the other side of the same argument and validating Steve King's point by suggesting that, yes, in order to change the culture, in order to change society, it is important that white people don't have children. And it's important that they lie down and basically sacrifice themselves to progressive change, to adopting a worldview, the leftist worldview of multiculturalism and this notion of equity. We're gonna cut off LeBron James at the knees in order to make his performance equal to, you know, the average Joe who wants to be just like him and perform just as well in the basketball court. That's the argument that she's making here. So, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't criticize Steve King for saying what he's saying and not in agreement with this professor from CUNY over there in New York, who's telling white people that by being white and having white children and having white families and having a will and testament that passes your property onto your children, that you're perpetuating white supremacy. You can't be both against King and for that. From Yahoo News, GOP Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore stunned some listeners when he said he thought America was great during the era of slavery. Though he made the comments at a campaign rally in Florence, Alabama, more than 2 months ago, they've reemerged in a viral tweet just days before the election. Back in September, one of the few African Americans in the crowd asked the candidate when he thought was the last time America was great. "I think it was great at the time when families were united. Even though we had slavery, they cared for one another. Our families were strong. Our country had a direction," Moore responded, according to a Los Angeles Times report in September. And then it goes on to talk about how horrible Roy Moore is for saying that the country was great when we had slavery. Now, again, similar to, and, you know, obviously, you know, if you've been listening to the program for any length of time, I'm not a Roy Moore fan. I'm not a Roy Moore supporter, but I call balls and strikes, okay? And this, to suggest that Roy Moore is somehow endorsing slavery here or discounting the moral injustice of slavery, or acting as though slavery is a great thing and slavery is the defining aspect of a great America, is pretty absurd. Looking at the language, looking at how what he says and how he says it, the phrase where he evoked slavery was, "even though we had slavery." And then he goes on to talk about how America was great. In other words, in spite of the fact that we had this institution that was horrible, that was an atrocity, that should not have existed, we nonetheless, as he goes on to say, cared for one another, our families were strong, our country had a direction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is kind of similar to the ongoing effort amongst the left to try to tear down Confederate monuments and tear down to rename Lake Calhoun and all this nonsense. The idea that any reference to slavery or any reference to a part of our history that is less than noble ought to completely invalidate the rest of the package, right? That you have to tear down the monument to Thomas Jefferson, let's say, because Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. As if that completely invalidates every other contribution he made as the author of the Declaration of Independence, as the author of the religious freedom statute in Virginia, you know, as one of the founding fathers. We need to throw all of that baby out with the little bit of bathwater of he owned slaves. Is it possible to acknowledge that, yeah, indeed, America was great at its founding? That you could not have the American Revolution, you could not have the authorship of the Declaration of Independence, the establishment of the Constitution, outside of a context of greatness? Can we acknowledge that and also acknowledge that slavery was wrong? Or do we have to throw it all in the garbage? The left would tell you that we have to throw it all in the garbage. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us, and we take calls from all across the metro area and all across the nation. Right now on the line, Angeli? Is this the...
Yep.
Angeli in Las Vegas. How you doing?
I'm doing good, man. I just tuned in. Angeli Ribelli chiming in. I'm not sure if I'm... totally aligned with what you were chatting about, but I would like to chit chat about this sexual harassment idea.
Go right ahead, man. It's 10:30 on a Friday night. You can talk about whatever you want. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Well, here's my thing. Can I ask your age? I've gone around the sun 50 times, so I want to make sure. I don't know.
I see what you're saying. A little bit down from that. 38. 39, okay. Actually. I just had a birthday. What am I talking about?
I don't know.
Can't keep track of it.
A dig. Anyway, I love you. But here's the thing. So I think that this might be a meme, and now I'm not sure, and I'm gonna throw this out at you and see what happens.
Okay.
So let me ask you this. Have you ever pinched a girl on the butt so that you know that I'm not setting you up? I have. Okay.
So, like, the technical answer to your question is yes. Okay.
Okay. Well, for me, it's not technical. The answer is yes.
Okay.
And then on the backdoor side, I was going to say, has any girl ever pinched you on the butt? And then, of course, I'm going to say yes. Now, for me, I thought that was a compliment, right?
Right. Right. Right.
So, right. So, what I'm saying, you know the three most masterful books that have ever been written, right?
I'm about to find out.
Well, good for you, man. Thanks for playing with me. You're an awesome badminton player. 1984, Brave New World.
Yeah.
And The Tomorrow File.
Sure.
Which is the one that everyone must read, and I'm certain that you haven't.
You're correct.
What I'm saying to you is, in one of those books, and I don't remember because I don't have them in my library, but in one of those books, the so-called masters, right, they want everyone to be hooked up to a VR machine, a virtual reality machine where you can, you know, do that little thing that we don't want to talk about. and then they take you in, they put it in the petri dish, and there you go. So that's what I'm saying. I mean, it might be, it might sound a little conspiracy, but what I'm saying to you, do you agree with my my theory here?
I'm not hearing your theory. What's your theory?
The theory is, the theory is there's something odd going on here. I don't believe that. Here's the thing. If I pinch a girl on the butt, I don't think that's sexual harassment. Do you?
Well, it totally depends on the context. That's why I said the technical answer to your question is yes, right? But it means different things in different contexts. There's context in which it's appropriate and context in which it's not.
Totally agree with you, but let me do it this way. I mean, where's the dividing line?
All right, we got to be done with that. Yeah, I was really hopeful for the direction that call was going because it seemed as though we could have gone straight to 11 with that guy.
Unfortunately, the FCC is still listening on a Friday night.
Yeah. So yes, we got to dump you when you go in that direction. I now have to recover from that.
That was weird.
That was odd. I still don't know. Unfortunately, I didn't get what his theory was. It seemed as though he was trying to build up to some sort of masterful explanation for. This looks like he's trying to call back. Some sort of masterful explanation for where this is all headed. That all the series, the sequence of accusations of sexual misconduct are going to lead us to some version of A Brave New World. I don't know. I would need him to explain it. And of course, that's not going to happen because you can't swear on the air. All right. So over at the Daily Wire, Matt Walsh has an interesting commentary. Matt Walsh is one of my favorite commentators, right up there with, if not surpassing, Ben Shapiro. And the reason why I really like Matt Walsh is that he marches to the beat of a different drummer. I mean, he does respond to things that are in the news, but he doesn't follow the news cycle. He's willing to take you out of what everybody's talking about right now to point you to something that people are not talking about right now. And that's what this piece that we're about to read from here at the Daily Wire does. He says, I've long been a vocal supporter of law enforcement. Anyone curious about my credentials in this area need only Google my name and police to see how often I've defended them and how often I've been lambasted by the left for doing so. But my support for a group of flawed mortal beings must always come with qualifications. Supporting cops must not mean defending them in every situation, no matter what. I support them. I don't bow before them. I give them leeway. I don't give them carte blanche. There are limits. This case, and then he links to a story, exceeds those limits. Philip Brailsford, a former Mesa, Arizona police officer, was somehow acquitted this week of murder and manslaughter in the shooting to death of a drunk, unarmed man. Unlike more high-profile cases of alleged police brutality, this incident was caught clearly and in its entirety, from start to finish, on camera. I'll tell you what the footage shows, and then he goes on to describe it. Brailsford was called to a hotel in Mesa back in January of 2016 on reports that someone had been pointing a rifle out of a window. Daniel Schaefer, very drunk at the time, had apparently been messing around with a few pellet guns that he used in his pest control job. Exceedingly stupid behavior on his part, but not deserving of the death penalty. Still, Brailsford and the other responding officers could not have known that they were pellet guns, so it's understandable that they were on edge. But this is where it gets not so understandable. Schaefer emerges stumbling out of his hotel room. He's told to get on the ground, and he immediately complies. Schaefer attempts to follow every instruction shouted at him, but he has difficulty because the instructions make no sense. Here's a verbatim transcript of everything Brailsford told Schaefer to do as he pointed his rifle at him and threatened repeatedly to kill him. Lie on the ground. Put both hands on top of your head and interlace your fingers. Take your feet and cross your left foot over your right foot. Keep your feet crossed. Put both hands flat in front of you. While they're on his head interlaced, push yourself to a kneeling position. Have you ever tried to push yourself up while your arms are extended all the way out in front of you? Put both hands in the air. Crawl towards me. with his hands in the air. Stop. Crawl. Keep your legs crossed. Put your hands in the air. Keep your legs crossed. Crawl. In the midst of this flurry of hysterical, arbitrary commands, as Brailsford continually reminds Schaefer that he'll die if he, quote, makes a mistake, unquote, Schaefer cries and begs for his life. Then comes the fatal moment. As Schaefer crawls awkwardly and wobbly, trying to keep up with this deadly game of Simon Says, his pants begin to fall down. He reaches to pull them up, and Brailsford immediately sprays him with bullets. Schaefer followed this ridiculous instructions for 5 minutes and still wound up dead. Now, Walsh goes on to point out that we are not talking about this in the mainstream news. Why? Because the victim in this instance was white. It doesn't fit the narrative. When we come back, I'm going to take a call here from Jeremy from Anoka, who wants to go all the way back to the beginning of the program to talk about Quentin Tarantino. Hey, I'm with you, man. We'll get to it on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. All right, cruising in the weekend here on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Stream us at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app, 651-989-5855. The number to join us, Brett Omland, taking those calls. We got Jeremy in Anoka on the line. How you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm doing great tonight. What a great show, an extended version. What a roller coaster. I mean, you got everything from Abdi to the 1984 conspiracy guy. Right. You started off with the A topic, and then you kind of just
brushed it
under the rug.
Right.
Tarantino directing a new Star Trek movie.
I know.
I thought about it, and your producer's analogy or as a reference of the weird food combination thing. I'm not sure about that. I will say though, if it goes anything like Christopher Nolan directing Batman, that would be awesome.
Well, sure. But the thing about Christopher Nolan and Batman is, and maybe you know what? You've actually tripped upon something that could fix my mindset on this. Because, you know, maybe it's like a James Bond situation. Like James Bond, even though there's been a certain amount of continuity between certain films, like the Sean Connery films kind of fit together and the Roger Moore films kind of fit together and had similar themes and characters and what have you. It seems like every time they cast a new guy, it's almost like a soft reboot of the franchise. And maybe that's the way to think of this, because Christopher Nolan taking on Batman, he rebooted it. He wasn't like trying to continue what had been done under Tim Burton. This was a whole new thing. And so if with Quentin Tarantino, they're basically saying, hey, this is like an Elseworlds, you know, alternate reality version of Star Trek as done by Quentin Tarantino, then I could get on board with that. That would be interesting. What I don't like is like what they're doing with this Star Trek Discovery, which I don't know if you've watched that at all, where they're claiming this is canon. This is part of, you know, the 1960s Star Trek and the Next Generation. This fits in that universe, except for the fact that it doesn't fit in that universe at all.
I remember you bringing that up months ago, and wasn't there some sort of a almost like a forced diversity element in that?
Oh yeah. No, there've been articles written about how the producers of this latest show, which you could only view on CBS Access, their private streaming service, how their intention was basically to get all, you know, a social justice warrior on you and turn Star Trek into, which, you know, Star Trek has always been a quote-unquote progressive show that's trying to promote notions of diversity and tolerance and what have you. But they're taking it to the next level where it's like militant. They have admitted that their storyline with they've redesigned the Klingons to be something totally different from what they ever were in any of the previous series, both physically and otherwise. And they've basically admitted that the Klingons are stand-ins for Donald Trump and Trump supporters.
I'll say this much. If Samuel Jackson's involved somehow, and if this is rated R and there are some curse words, this could get really interesting.
It could. I'm not saying it won't have entertainment value. I'm just saying it's not Star Trek. You know what I'm saying? Like, it can be good for what it is, But I just wish that it would. I want real Star Trek to come back. And I don't know if that's even possible nowadays, because I think that it may be one of those things that was a product of our culture at the time that it was produced. And our culture has now changed to the point, because that's the thing, is I kind of go through, there are two things that I go through every year, it seems like. I read the Bible every year, and I watch Star Trek every year. Right?
Okay.
So
How did you feel about the movie iterations, you know, like Wrath of Khan and things like that?
Oh, they were great. They were great. They added to, I mean, they changed some of the design elements and what have you. But there are two things about the way that they changed the design elements that made that okay. One, it was kind of in line with where what the technology enabled. And two, they had continuity from that point forward. When they changed something, they stuck with it moving forward. Whereas the changes that they're making most recently seem to be pretty arbitrary, and to the extent that they have any reason behind them at all, it's this weird sort of social justice warrior motivation for doing something.
Okay.
Which isn't particularly compelling for me.
New show.
Don't waste your time.
All right. Well, I'm glad I brought it back up, because I felt like you guys were kind of pushing it to the side.
Well, I appreciate it.
All right. Show, Walter.
Yep, you take care. All right, so there you go. You know, I'm not lying when I say, you know, it gets to be 10 o'clock on a Friday night, and, you know, you can just call up with whatever, and we'll go down that path.
So, I mean, we're tired.
Oh, yeah, I'm utterly exhausted. Can't wait to get home and get to sleep. But before we get to that point, let's touch back here to Matt Walsh's piece over the Daily Wire regarding this case wherein a police officer was found not guilty. He was acquitted on charges of murder, and I believe it was manslaughter, relating to the shooting death of a man by the name of Daniel Shaver. The officer's name was Brailsford, and basically what happened was the officer got called to a hotel back in January of 2016 on a report that somebody had been pointing a rifle out of a window. Turns out that it was Shaver, and Shaver was drunk at the time, and he was messing around with some pellet guns. Now, obviously, the officers didn't know that at the time, and so they're going in on edge, as one might expect. But then, as Matt Walsh points out, the sequence of events that followed was very bizarre in terms of the orders that were being given to Shaver by Brailsford during the encounter, many of which contradicted one another. You know, lie on the ground, put your hands on top of your head, then put your hands out in front of you, then crawl, but keep your hands out, you know. You can't do all these things at once. And the guy's drunk while he's being given all these directions. And then his pants start to slide down. And then he reaches to pull up his pants. And the cop shoots him and says, oh, he's reaching for something. Right. So, you know, Matt Walsh continues writing at the Daily Wire. Anyone who would think of defending the cops here, try this. Lie on the ground, interlace your fingers, put your hands out in front of you, cross your legs, and crawl with your hands in the air. Now, imagining attempting this same act in contortion with police officers pointing rifles at you and a guy shouting that he'll kill you if you mess up. Now, imagine all of that, but you've had a few beers. Do you think you would have gotten out of this alive? So, was Brailsford, the officer, acting like a law enforcement officer concerned with serving and protecting, or was he behaving like a jumpy, angry, incompetent, scared little bully on a power trip? I would say the latter. And the man is dead because of it. In fact, the Mesa Police Department seems to agree that Brailsford was bad at his job. They fired him several months ago for unsatisfactory performance. Part of his unsatisfactory performance is the fact that he scrawled the phrase, "You're effed," on the dust cover of his service rifle. The jury was not allowed to see that piece of evidence, but it does seem to give us a bit of a window into Brailsford's mindset. When he points his rifle at you, he says, "You're effed." He wasn't lying. Nobody can accuse him of bluffing on that score. However, we can accuse him of murdering an innocent man. And I will still make that accusation, no matter what the jury decided. The video and common sense speaks for itself. Yet, somehow, this case has gotten very little attention from the national media. This is easily the most clear-cut and blatant example of honest-to-God police brutality that we've seen in years, and it's all on film. Yet, I only found out about it because someone I follow on Twitter happened to mention it. Apparently, a few prominent Black Lives Matter folks have spoken out about this case to their credit, but it certainly has not prompted mass protests and national attention. We have seen cases far murkier than this one plastered all over the front pages, while Shaver's death is treated like a minor story for the local press to handle. Why? Well, the answer seems obvious. Shaver was white. Had Shaver been a different shade, there would be riots in Phoenix and round-the-clock coverage on CNN. Daniel Shaver would be a name as famous and ubiquitous as Michael Brown and Freddie Gray, but that's not how things have worked, because the media isn't interested in exposing police misconduct generally. They're interested in exposing racially motivated police misconduct, even if they have to fabricate it out of thin air. That's really a shame, because there are some police officers, not the majority, but some, who have no business wearing a badge. They enjoy lording their power over helpless, subservient civilians, and they relish the opportunity to use force. It would be good if media was serious about exposing these cases when they happen, keeping the powers that be honest and holding them accountable for their behavior. A civilian shouldn't have to die because a cop was unsuited for the job. This isn't just an oops, we'll do better next time thing. Human life is sacred, and when it is taken wrongly, justice must be done. But sadly, very few people are interested in justice. Many people on one side are interested in advancing their racial narrative, while many on the other seem determined to paint police officers as selfless heroes in every situation, no matter how they actually conduct themselves. Justice, as usual, is lost in the fray, and so is Daniel Shaver. That, again, from Matt Walsh over at the Daily Wire. And, yeah, I don't even know what to add to that. It's just spot on correct on every point. And this is indicative of, this fits the theme of everything we seem to have been talking about in this program for many weeks now, if not the entire tenure of Closing Argument. And that theme is this. We need to approach the task of living in a rational manner that's focused on comprehending, perceiving, and applying truth. That needs to be our aim. Truth. Because it turns out that a successful negotiation of life requires an understanding of what is true. And it is quite literally, in many situations, life and death. That's how important it is. And yet, it seems as though any effort to pursue truth, which used to be the aim of philosophy, any effort to pursue truth has been pushed aside in favor of any given person's politics, political agendas, and partisan loyalties. That is a problem that our civilization is not going to be able to withstand. Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Before the show began this evening, I went on social media and said that I was going to do something. And we're down here to the last segment, and so I guess now is when I'm going to do it. We're going to talk about this story out of Fox News. Here's the headline. Porn star August Ames commits suicide after bullying for refusing to have sex with man who did gay porn. Wow. I was going to say that it's a mouthful, but I mean, you know, phrasing in this context here. Closing Argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. So, okay, here's this story. A porn star relentlessly bullied on Twitter after saying she did not want to have sex with someone who had shot gay porn committed suicide by hanging. August Ames, a 23-year-old rising star in the adult film industry, died Tuesday in California. The Ventura County Medical Examiner confirmed to The Blast, which is apparently some news organization, that Ames died of asphyxiation due to hanging. She was the kindest person I've ever knew, and she meant the world to me. Her husband, Kevin Moore, told industry trade magazine Adult Video News. It's really, like, I'm trying to take the story seriously because a woman died, and that is serious. But this, there's also a kind of a comic irony to the way this story plays out. The quotes are coming from adult industry magazines and what have you.
But it makes a good social point. Like, go on, but go on. We'll get there.
Oh, man. Okay. So according to AVN, again, the trade industry magazine for adult film, Ames joined the adult film industry in 2013 and steadily rose to prominence, mostly thanks to a large following on social media. Close friends told The Blast that they suspect her social media presence and recent harassment may have contributed to her death. In recent days, Ames' Twitter feed has been littered with cyberbullies accusing her of being homophobic after she publicly chose to not work with an unidentified actor who had previously shot gay porn. She had tweeted, "Whichever lady performer is replacing me tomorrow, you're shooting with a guy who has shot gay porn, just to let you know. BS is all I can say," she wrote in a tweet earlier this month. "Do agents really not care about who they're representing? I do my homework for my body." And again, look, I appreciate that she has standards. I appreciate that she has a concern for her body and for her health. But this seems like a really low standard to me.
But, who do you think she was bullied by on Twitter?
Oh, by the left.
Who are the same people who say a woman has a right to choose what she does with her body?
Correct. Good. I didn't even think about it from that angle.
So she said, "I don't want to have sex with that person."
Right.
And everyone on the left blasted her for it.
This is really interesting.
Again, phrase.
This is really interesting because it goes to what we were talking about the last couple of days regarding the whole Christian Bakery and gay marriage deal, where the notion is that you don't get to consent to your transactions. If you are advertising that you have a certain product or service available at a certain price, then you are then obligated, according to the logic of public accommodation, you are then obligated to serve whoever walks in your door, no matter what, whether you agree with their values or disagree with their values, whether you want to engage in that particular transaction or not. What this is, to your point, Brad, and it's a pretty astute point, this is the application of that same concept to sexual relationships. It's saying that, you know, at your profession, your job, you know, is to go out there and have sex with guys on camera. Therefore, in order to not discriminate, you must be willing to do so with a guy who engages in gay porn. Regardless of your concerns, regardless of your personal beliefs or whatever the case may be. It's pretty astounding that maybe it's not. I mean, it's logical. There's a certain logic to it. Right, they're at least being consistent in their application of this absurd idea that you actually don't get to consent to the relationships that you engage in your life. You actually are obligated to engage in transactions that you fundamentally disagree with. That is the notion here. Now, what I said I was going to do on social media, and we got just enough time to do it here, is I think really the only proper response to this is to just read from Genesis 19. Okay. Two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, "My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise up early and go on your way." They said, "No, we will spend the night in the town square." But he pressed them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people, to the last man, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we may know them." Lot went out to the men at the entrance, shut the door after them. And of course, you know, he offered his daughters to replace the men. And their response was, "Stand back." And they said, "This fellow came to sojourn and he has become the judge." So even thousands of years ago, you still had a gay community that was decrying anybody who dared to suggest that their prescribed behavior in any given situation was wrong. Nothing has changed. There is nothing new under the sun. Solomon was right. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Broadcasting on AM 11.